Special guest now joining us on Book Corner, Tony Basilio, along with Alan Paul. He's the author of One Way Out, The Inside History of the Allman Brothers Band from St. Martin's Press. And Alan, first thing I want to do is welcome you along. What an incredible work by you.
Thank you very much.
And a labor of love as well. I could tell from the pages, the guys, it reads almost like an oral history, really open with you. They must be really comfortable with you.
Right. Well, you know, I worked on it in some degree or another for 25 years, which just shows it's a labor of love, because you'd have to be fairly insane to spend that much time working on something if you didn't love it. I wasn't literally writing a book for 25 years, but I've been reporting on the band, writing stories about the band, starting with Guitar World magazine and doing also some stuff for the Wall Street Journal and other places for 25 years. So it was just a slow accretion of material and of trust. I would say anyone, but certainly guys like the Allman Brothers, you can't just walk in and say, hey guys, you know, I'm a nice guy, you ought to trust me, let's do an article, let's do a book. You have to earn that trust, and you have to do it over years and years and years. So that's what I was able to do.
And those guys are so special, aren't they, in terms of their place? And I got that from you, that you really appreciate what a great band these guys have been for this long.
That's where the whole thing began for me, is I admired their work. I admired their singular place in American musical history. I don't think there's anybody else who's ever been really quite like them. And part of what I was trying to do with this book is get at the root of the whole thing, like get to the core and say, how did this band come to be? I mean, they're so much different than anyone else. They combine all various forms of American music, rock and roll, blues, country, jazz, in a way that nobody else really has. They are very singular, very unique, and that it really is what I was trying to get at from the first articles I've written about the band. Who are these guys? Where did they come from? How did they get here? And that's what I set out to do with the articles, and that's certainly what I set out to do with the book.
Yeah, and somebody listening would say, how did they come to be? So how would you answer that, Alan? How did they come to be?
Right. There's no easy answer, which is why you have to write a 460-page book to explain it. But, you know, what it really boils down to is that Duane Allman had this incredibly singular vision. And that's something that I tried to understand. And I think that I understood fairly well before I began how important Duane was to the whole process. But I think until I really wrote this book and did these particular interviews, I didn't fully appreciate it. Not only in terms of his musical genius, which sort of speaks for itself, but in terms of his vision and his ambition. And that's what it really boils down to, is Duane had this unique set of experiences. He had already been in a failed band with Greg out in Los Angeles. He had gone through this sort of record company thing, decided that wasn't for him, and was doing all kinds of other stuff, did all these great sessions in Muscle Shoals and in New York and at Atlantic Records with Wilson Pickett and Aretha Franklin and all kinds of great people. And he just had this expansive vision of what he would do with his own band. He wasn't going to settle for being like anyone else. And he set out to put together this group. And, you know, the first thing he did was hire two drummers, which was different than just about anyone else out there, and then go look for another great lead guitarist. And that is not what guitarists usually do. You know, lead guitarists, generally speaking, are like surgeons or fighter pilots. They're big ego, fill the room guys who want the attention on them, and they don't generally go off looking for someone else to share the spotlight. But that's what Duane did. He found that in Dickie Betts, another fantastic guitar player with a very different sound and approach. Again, I just think it really goes back to this expansive vision of Duane's and this incredible ambition and confidence. You know, he wasn't going to settle just for having a great band. He wanted to have the greatest band. Nothing was good enough for him. And so he kept pushing and pushing, and he pushed everyone else to be better, to do more, to think bigger. And that's what eventually led them to that place.
You know, Alan, we were talking before we started to record here today, as we visit with Alan Paul, One Way Out, The Inside History of the Allman Brothers Band. We were talking before we went on. You have a background. I know you're a musician. You have also covered sports. I make my living predominantly talking about sports. Let me give you an observation. This guy seems to me, and we talk about Dwayne Allman, it seems like in a lot of these athletes that are tremendous, that are a cut above, the Michael Jordans of the world, they're never satisfied.
Right.
They have a heart about them. They're not going to fail. They're not going to let others around them fail. And Dwayne Allman, from your portrayal and the words that others use about him all these years later, the guy left us at the age of 23.
Yeah,
it's
24.
Or 24.
But the point stands. Yeah,
yeah, it's incredible, right?
And I think, actually, I think the comparison you're making is an excellent one, and it's one that I have thought of. You know, as we said, I did do sports writing. I've done quite a bit of sports writing over the years. And one of the things I did for just about 10 years, I did all the old school interviews for Slam magazine. So I interviewed retired basketball greats like Larry Bird and Isaiah Thomas and Jerry West and many, many, many others, hundreds of them. And one of the things that struck me from the very beginning when I first started doing those interviews was that intensity, that lack of ever being satisfied. I think that you stated that very well. And it just struck me how much that is what separates them. Of course, they were incredibly skilled athletes. Of course, they had a great passion for the game. But it's that drive, that inability to be satisfied, that refusal to stop and say, this is good enough, that separated them in the end from their peers and from everyone else. And I think that's very well put. That's something that Dwayne had. You know, actually, at one point in the writing of the book, I was interviewing Butch Trux, a founding drummer of the band, and something he said really impacted me and my vision of what I was doing with the book. And it was that he said, you know, Dwayne really fired us up with this concept that we could be the greatest band ever. And why would you not try to do that? If you're going to put in all the time and effort to be in a band, why wouldn't you try to be the best band ever? And I think that reflects that passion, that determination, that ambition. It made me stop in my tracks, and I thought, well, I can't honor his legacy. I can't capture the spirit of this band, of what this man created, unless I try to do that. I have to try to write the best book in the history of rock and roll books. Am I going to achieve that? Did I achieve that? I mean, probably not. It's, you know, it's not up for me to say, but the concept really stuck with me, that, you know, came directly from Dwayne through Butch. If you're going to do this, why not try to do that? What else are you doing? What are you wasting your time doing if you're not doing that? So I think it was incredibly influential vision on these guys. I think it lit them up. And one of the things that really, really struck me in doing all these interviews is the extent to which these guys talk about Dwayne like someone who was in the room with him a week ago, not somebody who's been dead for 43 years. It's really striking, and to the extent that he continues to sort of inspire and drive the band, it's quite remarkable.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And let's go back to that sports analogy for a second. You know, many of those great athletes, we have a tendency to look at the finished product. And when you see the finished product, you see the guy who's rich and famous, and he's made it, and he's there, because that's the time they come onto our radar. Now, you know from dealing with those guys, and I do from dealing with guys who have made it big, that it's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of sweat. In many cases, it's getting cut from teams. It's people telling you no. And the Allman Brothers story, I think the thing that really surprised me, and you illuminated this, and you really got the guys to share in their struggles early on, is that they made music early on as a band, and the music world really didn't notice. They did
right.
Some great things, but yet they didn't really break through until almost the end for Dwayne Allman, ironically enough. Isn't that
right.
The case?
Well, that's right. And you're right. It did take that hard work, and it took them sticking with it. And it also took the continuing support, financial and otherwise, of their manager and record label president, Phil Walden. You know, he was their manager. He was their record company. They controlled their song publishing. And all of these things really are a tremendous conflict of interest, which eventually led to a lot of bad feelings and lawsuits and ugliness. And that can't be covered up and shouldn't be covered up either. But At the same time, none of it would have ever existed without him, without his incredible support during those years, especially when they weren't making any money. He was supporting them. He kept them on the road. He was paying everything to the tune of close to $250,000 before he started getting a penny back. And remember, that was in 1970 or $71. So we're really talking about a very considerable amount of money. So that's also part of the story.
It's a major part of the story. You talked about it before. How special is a guy like Dwayne Allman to look at his brother and go, hey, get back here from the coast. We've got something special going here. I need you to get back here to complete this thing. There was sort of a sales job there, wasn't there?
Right, and that's one of those examples where it's not exactly clear what happened. You know, either Greg didn't want to come back and Dwayne had to call him repeatedly and convince him that this was a great thing and they needed him to be part of it, or he called him once and he came right away, which is what Greg says. Most of the other guys, you know, say that he needed some convincing, so I will go with that. But I think that Greg obviously had faith in his brother. They had certainly had differences being in a band together. Being in a band is a very intimate, intense thing. Being in a band with someone that you're close with can be difficult. Long history of brothers not getting along in bands, from the Everly Brothers through Oasis and the Robinson Brothers and the Black Crowes. There's nothing new there. But Greg and Dwayne obviously realized they were better together. They had lost their father at a very young age. And by all accounts, Dwayne was not only a brother, not only were they extremely close, but Dwayne was really a father figure. He was, in fact, his father, you could say, although they were only a year apart. So there was a lot of complications in their relationship, but clearly they had something very special together. Clearly they were very close, and clearly they created something together greater than either of them could have or would have done separately.
And you talked about some of the early pieces that he found, talking about Dwayne Allman for the band. You know, a guy who really comes across as likable right up to the present day, who I think really understands the spirit and is in tune with carrying on the spirit of Dwayne Allman is J-Mo. And I was glad to see, and I was glad to see you shine the light on him. Boy, he seems like a good soul.
Yeah, it's funny. I got a message from someone that said, you know, serious question, is J-Mo Buddha? And I understood where that was coming from. He does sort of come across that way. It's certainly not my creation. That's just a reflection of how J-Mo came across to me, really. J-Mo, before I began this book project, was the member of the band I knew the least and really has become the person I'm closest with through many, many, many hours of interviews and spending time with him. He's a wonderful guy. He's everything that I think he appears to be in the book. He's smart. He's thoughtful. He was the first person hired by Dwayne to be in his new band. So he's been there from the very, very beginning. And he's honest, and he's not afraid to tell stories that make himself or people that he's close with and cares about look a little bit bad if he feels that's the truth. And as a writer, you know, all of those are just incredible things in a subject. So J-Mo's a wonderful person, a wonderful musician who I think has been very, very central to the band's sound. I mean, you talk about the Allman Brothers being blues with a twist, rock with a twist, jazz with a twist, and whatnot. And basically, J-Mo is the twist. He has a different take on things, a different vision, a different perspective, and it's had a very deep and lasting impact on the Allman Brothers' music.
One Way Out is the book from St. Martin's Press. We're visiting with Alan Paul. It's the inside history of the Allman Brothers Band. And believe me when I tell you, when I say inside history, this thing is the inside history. In fact, it's extremely inside. Alan, parts of this, and you talked about J-Mo, how honest he is with you. I'm thinking, how are other guys in the band going to respond when they see this, or other guys who are talked about here, or have given their cooperation? What has the blowback been like for you from that standpoint?
Well, it's been fine, actually. I was certainly worried about that. I was particularly worried about JMO and Butch Trucks because Butch wrote the foreword, JMO wrote the afterword. Their names are on the cover. They did not pre-approve or read the book beforehand. They had to trust me and have faith in me. Because of their assistance, their editorial contributions, and the fact that their names were on the cover, if they had been really upset about it, that would have upset me. But with everything else, you know, I just had to let the chips fall as they may. And everybody understood. Again, I have a long history with these guys. I've written about them for 25 years. Nobody asked me to not write about things. Nobody asked me to cover anything up. And they all understood that I was going to write something as true to the truth as I could, as I could get to. And I think that they're at a state in their career and in their lives where that's what they want. That was very much the goal. So I encountered absolutely no resistance, no pushback, no fighting about anything, which is great. And in all the years I've done interviews, there really has never been anything off topic, with the exception of Greg really not wanting to talk about Cher and his marriage or relationship. I'm not even sure at this point, but I think that was stated to me very early on. It was sort of understood. Now, you know, I was doing most of my interviews originally for Guitar World magazine, and so it was understood that I was there to talk about the music and the origin of the music, so that was never an issue. Other than that, everything has really been out and open. And again, they trusted me. I'm not focused on salacious aspects. All focus on why we care about them, which is this incredible music they've created. At the same time, you can't understand the history of the Allman Brothers, who they are, where this all came from, unless you do understand some of these terrible things that have happened, some of the problems they've had, some of the struggles they've had with drugs, with alcohol, with violence. It's a part of the story, and you just can't really understand the band without understanding that. So certainly it's all covered, but the goal was to write about it in ways that it impacted the music. When things had happened but didn't have a direct impact on the music, I tended to let that go.
I think you did a great job with that. And I think it's very difficult, you know, because in the day and age in which we live, and I know publishers, I'm not going to speak for St. Martin's Press, but different authors I've talked to will say, well, you know, they wanted to really push that out front and let's get a little bit of controversy here.
Right. Well, I have to give great props, actually, to my editor, Mark Resnick, and St. Martin's Press, because I had almost no pressure of that sort. I had no pressure of that sort. You know, we talked about it from the beginning. They understood what my approach was going to be, and they very much approved it. And the book's done really well, so I guess all of our vision of what it should be was vindicated, which is nice, so I don't think anyone has any second thoughts about that.
Some of the asides in the book are so refreshing. Where Sweet Melissa came from, for instance.
And, yeah, thank you. I'm glad you mentioned that. That was a story I was really proud of.
Tell me about it.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about it is that Greg realized pretty early on that if he was really going to make it, if they, Greg and Duane, were really going to make it, they had to be writing original music. And he was trying from a very early age to do that. And he told me that he wrote and threw out 400 songs. Now, when he told me that, I questioned him. I said, Greg, you're exaggerating on purpose, right? It wasn't really 400 songs. And he insisted, no, it was 400 songs. So, you know, I still don't know exactly how many it was, but Melissa was one of the first ones that he hit that he felt was really a great song. This was way back in 1967, several years before the Allman Brothers formed. And he wrote the song, and it all sort of came to him, and it was just, he was a little bit lonely. They were out on the road. He was really just a teenager, and he envisioned Melissa as this perfect woman who was waiting for him somewhere, you know, who didn't exist. It wasn't really written for a person. It was written for a dream of the person that he wished he had had in his life. And he wrote the whole song, but he didn't have the name. So he would say, but back home, he'll always run to Sweet. And he was just stuck. He had the whole song, but without the name. Who should that be? Sweet who? And he was trying different names. Stella, sweet this, sweet that. And he says that he was at the grocery store at night, and there was a woman there, beautiful Hispanic woman, whose daughter ran away down the aisle, 2 or 3 years old, and the mother yelled out after her, "Wait, Melissa, stop!" And it hit him like a ton of bricks, and he knew that was it. That was the name that he was looking for. And he claims he dropped his quart of milk and ran home and finished writing the song, home actually being a hotel room, finished the song, and that was it. And that was in 1967. In the following year, Greg and Duane did record a demo of that, actually with Butch Truck's band, the 31st of February, and it just sat there. They never recorded it. It became a song that they would play sitting around the campfire at night out at Idlewild South, which was a sort of party pad they had outside of Macon. But Greg said that he thought it was too soft of a song for the Allman Brothers, and he was sort of saving it for a solo record that he figured he would do someday. In the meantime, Duane told him it was his favorite song he'd written. That was the first song he wrote that was a keeper, but obviously he didn't really record it other than that demo, so there started to be many other songs he wrote, Whipping Post and Midnight Rider and Please Call Home and many others. In the meantime, he still had Melissa. Well, when Duane died, he got up and played that by himself at Duane's funeral and said, "This was my brother's favorite song of mine." And then they recorded it on Eat a Peach, which was they were halfway through at the time of Duane's death. So the song then, obviously, is a beautiful song, but it gained a lot more even poignancy and meaning to Greg and to the band because it became associated with Duane's death and with his funeral.
Yeah, and when you listen to that song now, at least I have, I found myself listening to that lyric thinking, what must it have been like for those people at the memorial service for this young man who's taken away way too soon to hear his brother and sing with that kind of emotion? And then furthermore, you talked to Dickie Betts about his guitar work in that. It's haunting, and it's beautiful, and it's just all
and
there.
And that's important to note. I mean, Dickie's guitar part really turned it from a lovely little ballad into just a gorgeous song, a gorgeous piece of work. And the way Dickie tells the story in the book there is that they were worked on in the studio, and everyone could hear that it was a beautiful song, but that it needed a little bit more. It needed something. And so they listened to it, and Dickie said he took a tape home and said, "I'm going to come up with something tomorrow. I'll bring it in." And they went home, and Dickie listened to it and just came up with that whole lead guitar part in one fell swoop. And he said he brought it in, and the next day was Greg's birthday, and he kind of said, "Happy birthday, brother," played the song. I played his guitar part, and the song was complete. They recorded it, and that was it. And that's, of course, one of their most famous and best-loved songs.
These guys are incredibly talented and fiercely gifted and seem like, at points in this book, like some really strong-willed human beings. As we visit with Allan Paul today, One Way Out, the inside history of the Allman Brothers Band from St. Martin's Press. Let me tell you something. If you like music, I recommend you read this. You will not be able to put it down. If you enjoy the Allman Brothers in any way, shape, or form, this is an incredible work. And Alan was being, he said earlier, he sat down to write a tremendous book that did these guys justice, and I think he's done exactly that. And Alan, let me ask you, one of the guys that seems really complex in this book, and I can't figure him out, I love him, I appreciate him, I think he's really talented. We were just talking about Dickie Betts a second ago. I can't figure this guy out when I read this book.
Right. Well, and Dickie is a complex character, and I guess that complexity is part of what makes the Allman Brothers so unique and so different. You know, I think that Dickie's guitar sound has a huge amount to do with the sound that we associate with the Allman Brothers. He has a very, very distinct sense of melody. Once you're familiar with his playing and you start to pick out what he's doing versus what Duane is doing, and once you're familiar with his concepts, you start to realize how much of the musical underpinning of the band came from the mind of Dickie Betts. I really believe that. He didn't sing at all until their third album. The first song he sang was Blue Sky, you know, just a masterful vocal. And he ended up writing and recording their biggest hit, Ramblin' Man. He's an incredibly complex character. He can write the most beautiful, lovely songs and melodies like Blue Sky, like Jessica, which I think might be the greatest rock instrumental ever and probably the happiest rock song ever written. And then the flip side is that he has a dark and violent temperament at times. It came out in ugly ways. He beat people up. He threatened them. He had his demons, serious drug and alcohol problems that usually would be the trigger for the violence. And that's the complexity of Dickie Betts. I mean, the same mind that wrote these beautiful songs like Jessica, like Blue Sky, also was capable of extremely violent and intimidating behavior. So I don't think it's wrong that you had a hard time figuring him out. I think that that to some extent means I captured his personality pretty well, because it's not a simple picture. It'd be easy to take the negative sides and paint Dickie as some kind of monster, but that's not accurate. That's not complete. Dickie can be a wonderful, caring, thoughtful, interesting guy. I mean, I've had wonderful, wonderful interviews with Dickie. I've spent a lot of time with him, and I really like him, and I like good Dickie a lot. And I didn't relish having to write about some of the ugly things. But again, I wasn't trying to be salacious, just simply, you can't begin to understand the Allman Brothers, the complexity, the story, the history, where they came from, what they did, without understanding that, because it just is such a big part of their story, especially in the post-Dwayne years, in which there was this big leadership vacuum, and there was always a question about who was in charge and who they were going to follow.
Yeah, and I think it's a miracle they've stayed together. Yeah. Especially with him on board.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you said that, because I have made that point, and I do believe it, actually, that it's easy to focus on the failures and what happened and the sadness of it breaking apart with Dickie, who left the band in 2000, you know, under duress. There's still to this day disputes among them whether they fired him or whether he quit. It's hard to exactly get to the bottom of it, because it just depends on the interpretation of various things. But I think that it is a really valuable perspective to think, what really is more remarkable is not that it finally blew apart and ended in 2000, but that they lasted as long as they did, and they did as good of a job making great music for as long as they did in the years after Dwayne's death. So I think that that actually is the correct and appropriate perspective to have.
Another thing that I love about these guys is that it didn't matter what kind of player you were. It mattered what kind of teammate you were to these guys. Who's the hotshot guitar player? Was it Zakk Wylde that you write about?
Yeah.
They were just looking at each other like, what in the world is this guy doing? Tell the story.
Right. Well, I think that's, you know, to be fair to Zakk, and it was a ridiculous situation. He was there because Dickie got arrested for punching a cop, basically, who came because his wife had called the police because he was abusing her in a hotel room in Saratoga, New York, because he was drunk, and had to leave the tour. So that's the behavior that I think is really should be ashamed of. They didn't want to cancel a gig. They started calling around. Jack Pearson, who eventually did become a member of the band, was unavailable. He was the first person they called. They tried to get a hold of David Grissom, great Texas guitar player who at the time was playing with John Mellencamp. They couldn't reach him in time. And so they called Zakk Wylde, who was playing with Ozzy Osbourne. And I was spending actually quite a bit of time with Zakk at this time. While I was at Guitar World, we became quite friendly. And Zakk was just out of his mind with excitement. He loved the Allman Brothers. He loved Lynyrd Skynyrd. And to be fair, was put in, I think, an insane position where they basically called him up at his home in Los Angeles and said, can you play with us in Boston tomorrow night? He, of course, said yes, because it was like a dream come true for him. So they said, good, go get a red eye. So he took a red eye to Boston. They picked him up at the airport, took him to the show. His rehearsal consisted of an hour-long sound check. And I think Zakk could play the songs note for note, more or less, but that's not what Zakk did. Zakk's approach was totally wrong for the Allman Brothers. His tone was completely wrong for the Allman Brothers. His stage mannerisms, running around on stage like a crazy lunatic, was completely wrong for the Allman Brothers. But again, I don't know if it's really fair to blame Zakk, who was put in this pretty ridiculous position of being thrown out there, taking a red eye and playing the show. But they were so unhappy that by the time the show was over, they were already on the phone, and they did get a hold of David Grissom in Texas this time, and they flew him out, and he did a similar thing, and they basically drove Zach to the airport in Washington, D.C., dropped him off for a flight and said, "See you later, brother." Picked up David Grissom, who played that night in Maryland. So, you know, that's the kind of things that went on in Allman Brothers land. It's not been a calm, cool, and collected run for the band.
Alan Paul, One Way Out, The Inside History of the Allman Brothers Band from St. Martin's Press. And I highly encourage you to check it out, because believe me, as great as this piece is with him, and this is a great piece, he absolutely hammers it out of the park in this book. And, you know, as somebody who plays music myself, I appreciate what you unearth from the two guitar players that are synonymous with the latter part of the incarnation of the Allman Brothers. And I'm speaking of both Derek Trucks and also Warren Haynes. Both these guys talk about how they decided to go back to the original canon, to the original stuff, and learn the parts. And when they're on stage, they have the parts down, and they've augmented what they got from the original canon. But it was important for them to maintain a lot of the authenticity of what's gone on with the Allman Brothers through the years. I thought that was really interesting.
Right, and the thing is that when Warren started playing with the band in 1989, when they first got back together, he was playing the Duane parts in all the classic songs. Well, he left the band in 1997. For 2 years by Jack Pearson, who I'd mentioned earlier. Then Jack left because of hearing problems, and Derek came in 2000 and basically took over all of Warren's parts. Well, in 2000, when they parted ways with Dickie Betts, they got Warren Haynes to come back, and all of a sudden what they realized was, gee, we both play the same parts, and neither of us really know how to play the Dickie parts, because, of course, Dickie played the Dickie parts. So they had to decide how they were going to do that, and they sat down and they decided that they would both learn both parts and then take turns every night and just mix it up a little bit, make it a little bit less predictable, less rote. And I think that in doing that, the sound became a little bit less consistent, because over the years there had been such a distinct difference between Dickie's parts and everyone else's, but it became very much more, what would be the word, alive. They were really on their toes. They're never playing things just by memory. They mixed it up by playing, tonight I'm playing this slide on One Way Out, tomorrow you're playing this slide on One Way Out. I think it remained really, really fresh, and I think that I'm not sure to what extent that was goal that they set at the beginning when they decided to do that, but I think that it really did have the effect of doing that.
Alan, on the way out, and I congratulate you again on this work, share with me, as somebody who followed that band around for 25 years, as you did, and interviewed them countless times, hundreds of hours, as you said, as you prepared to sit down and do this work, share with me a couple things that you learned that made doing this work for you worth it and time well spent.
First was something I had already mentioned, which was the extent to which Duane's personality drove this thing, the extent to which he had this incredible ambition and confidence, and that's what fired everyone up, and that's what they fed off of. And again, as I mentioned, the extent to which he remains very much a vital presence in the band 43 years after his death. I think I understood that intellectually, but I didn't fully get it until I experienced it, the conversations with these guys. Another is the full history and complexity, the relationship between Dickie Betts and the other guys in the band, especially with Dickie Betts and Greg Allman. There were several incidents over the years that I had either not known about or known about but not known the details about. And I think that I began to have a much clearer understanding of what happened in 2000 when the final split happened. And I hope that my readers, in reading the book, will have that same understanding. I think that when they get to Dickie's firing in 2000 or Dickie's leaving the band in 2000, it will not seem as out of the blue as it might have to them before or as it did at the time it happened. And that's something that is important to me.
Alan, I think you did, and I think it's nearly impossible to do those guys justice. But I can tell from the way you approach this how much you respect the subject matter, what those guys have been able to accomplish, and how they've just been able to maintain through the years such a high level of just, what's the word I'm looking for here?
Integrity, I think.
Yeah, I think. Integrity to the music, yeah. I really appreciate it, man. Thanks for stopping by with us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk, and especially to someone who is so enthusiastic about my book specifically, but I think just about books and the process of it more generally. So thank you.
Alan Paul, One Way Out, Inside History, Allman Brothers Band, St. Martin's Press. Check it out. And we thank him for his time today on Book Corner.
Thank you.